I'd like to describe some. So essentially, I mean, this conference has been wonderful for seeing a wide range of pattern formation, a whole bunch of different physical systems. But this is going to be a sort of a different flavor in the sense that we're going to look at one particular system. So the scope is limited in a sense. We're looking at one particular system kind of with a microscope in a sense. So I want to show you a lot of the pattern formation that can occur in this, sort of go to sketch the asymptotics, but I'm not going to give you the sort of rigorous proof. So it's work done with my graduate students, Theo Kolokonikoff and Jun Cheng Wei at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. So let me show you here a picture that interested me a few years ago. Let's see if this one's in focus. Oh, not so bad. So this is actually from a website of the simulations of a very simple reaction diffusion system in two dimensions. Actually, it's at Caltech, and the website is called Exmorphia. But it's sort of numerical computations on a system that was actually done by... How does this thing work? The red. Oh, yes, okay. Oh, look at that. Okay, well, it's not... By John Pearson. A paper came out in Science in 1993. So he came up with a very simple reaction diffusion system, sort of motivated a little bit by work of Harry Swinney and so, but basically the reaction diffusion system in the two-dimensional domain is just very, very simple. Okay? He was solving this thing in a square domain, and there's really sort of, there's parameters here, du, dv, the diffusion coefficients, both of which in non-dimensional units are small, and there's two parameters, f and k, and there's two chemical species. So you might think, well, what possibly could be new in this system? So then Roy Williams at Caltech with a supercomputer basically mapped out all the range of F versus K in a bifurcation diagram, starting with random initial data, and had a wonderful sort of audio visual website whereby in different regions of this parameter space, starting with random initial data in a two-dimensional domain, you can get a whole zoo of different behaviors. So if you clicked on the yellow dots, I was actually high-tech, I would have the movies and illustrations of it. But if you clicked on the yellow dots, you'd see movies of simulations of what the pattern is looking like in time, and the black dots indicate sort of snapshots at a fixed time. And so the pictures here that one would get with this are actually kind of a whole zoo of different things. So at parameter regime one, if you let the system go for a certain amount of time, you end up getting regular hexagon patterns, so the black dots indicate the maxima of U. And then in pattern two, so at a fixed instant in time, you see this irregular array of spots. So if you clicked on a movie that was near, if you clicked on a movie near here, you'd see spots that are oscillating in time up and down and moving kind of randomly in the plane. And then in pattern three, right, you basically get the inversion of this, the black eye pattern or the hole pattern that Ehud Melin had mentioned. And in region four, you get sort of the origins of labyrinthian patterns, these little snake-like things that come in. Okay, and so in the end, and in other regimes, you get pulse-splitting behavior. And so this is a terrible reproduction of this, but it's a paper by Lee and from Harry Swinney's group in 1994 in Nature, which basically one top part is the Gray-Scott model and the bottom part is an experiment. So on the eyeball comparison test, the phenomena looks something okay. So the question then is, what type of mathematics can one do to analyze the system in the limit where the diffusion coefficients are small, singularly perturbed? And I'll amplify what I mean by that in a minute. Let me just show you a few more pictures before I outline specifically what I'm going to do. So there's interesting, so if you want to try to do mathematics on this, you have to have a little bit more controlled experiment here in quotes meaning numerical simulation or analysis. And so there was really nice work by Morgan, who is a student of Tasso Kapper, and some proofs along the same lines by my student and Jun Cheng Wei, that basically says something like this. Start with a ring. So U is concentrated along a circle in the domain. So for certain ranges of the parameters, you can get this break up into spots. And that comes out by an instability due to certain large eigenvalues. So these spots then end up sort of proliferating throughout the whole domain. But the initial instability is this ring will break up in an unstable to give you a sort sort of the formation of spots. In other parameter regimes, and this is what, actually I'm not going to describe this today, but this is just to whet your appetite of what can happen. For other parameter regimes, is that you start off with a ring, okay, and basically there's another instability that can happen, not breaking up into spots like here, but actually breaking up into a zigzag pattern. Instabilities with respect to translations of the ring, in a sense. So this instability is slower, time scale here is longer, but basically gives you the initial formation of these labyrinthian patterns. All we can do is predict the onset of this instability, but there's two classes of eigenvalues that control these different types of instabilities. Okay? So let me show some pictures here from the Shira that I think, again, just to whet your appetite, before I'll disappoint you on actually what we do, okay? But again, you want to do a controlled experiment. So this is a wonderful simulation of Nishira and Yuyama, Physica D, 1999. So it starts with a dot, right? So basically a local maxima of U. And so as time goes on, this thing then breaks up into this peanut-shaped thing that ends up breaking up again, breaking up again, breaking up again. And so they did this carefully from numerics and then suggested a bifurcation scenario for which can try to explain that. So I'll explain that in one dimension. But this is the type of thing that one has to do, starting with a ring, starting with a spot, to try to look at the type of instabilities that can happen. So in a one dimension along this line, so that's what I'm really going to do today at the moment, is really one dimension. But it's, you take a look at something like this. And this is again from his paper, where both diffusion coefficients here are small, and you get basically a self-replicating pattern for the Great Scott model. So this is X, this is on the domain. As time goes on, it splits into patterns. Eventually, it kind of fills the domain. At least there's so the pattern replicates. So if you like anti-coarsening, I should mention that all these this problem has no variational structure, so it's not like it's trying to conserve energy or so. So at least it's not constrained by trying to minimize some energy. But if I'm going to plagiarize here one quote that I really liked from Pearson's paper in 1993, it's this. And this is completely plagiarized from, but I like this theme, and this is really the theme for today, is most work in this field, namely in the field of reaction diffusion systems, has focused on pattern formation basically by linearizing a PDE system around a spatially uniform steady state that is near the transition from linear stability to linear instability. With this restriction, standard bifurcation tools, such as what everybody probably knows here, amplitude equations, et cetera, symmetry groups, et cetera, have been used with considerable success, getting complex Ginzburg-Landau, Swift-Hohenberg, et cetera. But it's unclear whether the patterns presented here will yield to these standard technologies. So that's a direct plagiarism from his paper. So really the flavor of what I really want to talk about today is what's at the bottom here. So what can one say about the stability, dynamics, and equilibria of what I call like particle-like solutions to reaction diffusion systems? Particle-like meaning spot, localized in space, having an order one amplitude. So this, let's think of this as being some equilibrium solution. What about the stability of this? Right? What types of instabilities can this thing undergo? Right? Can it replicate, etc.? So basically, this is the building block from which we have to linearize around and look at its instabilities. So work in this direction, at least on the Gray-Scott model, is very good work in a series of papers by Dolman, Kapper, Gardner. Right. Nishira has some very interesting work on that. A lot of it's numerical, but at least there's a nice bifurcation thing that I'll show you later today. Muratov has done some things. But basically, this is try to go beyond the usual Turing idea of linearizing around uniform states. So let me leave that quote there, and let me tell you what we're going to do. So the first thing is, let me give you what... So basically, we're going to try to do everything we can in one dimension, looking at all sorts of different instabilities, try to look at pulse splitting, etc. So let me tell you my scaling of the original Gray-Scott model, and then I'll give you the specific outline. Okay, so basically, all we're going to do today is just basically this one equation. but try to look at really carefully the stability and equilibria of solutions of this form. Okay, so here, there's the reaction diffusion system of Gray and Scott. Okay, so initially we want to do an analysis of this, so we basically transform it to a different set of units, a different set of dimensionless variables that I think is particularly convenient. There's others that I'll explain later when I do comparisons with what's out there in the literature. But this is a nice non-dimensionalization of this system in the sense that there's three parameters that I've outlined in red, and I'm going to look at this in the semi-strong limit. This epsilon is small, so V is localized, but U, this concentration field, will vary over the length scale of the domain. So this is not Nishira's regime where, or Pearson's regime, where both variables are localized. So it's just one variable that's going to be localized. So in the language of Dolman et al., this is called the semi-strong interaction regime. V is local, but U is a global variable. And so there's really three parameters that will control the equilibrium stability. Tau only controls the stability of the solution, so it's nicely represented out here, and the equilibrium, et cetera, will appear in this A and this D. So that's the system that we're going to look at. So this will be the picture of the different regimes that we're going to describe, and I'll show you a bunch of pictures here. So you have to have a little name for the different regimes with different behaviors, and so this is what we have. So I call the high feed rate regime, and this is where you actually can get interesting pulse splitting behavior that has been computed numerically, but not, there's no real theory for this, in the regime where A is order 1, D is order 1, and epsilon is small. So U is global, V is local. So this is semi-strong in the language of Dolman et al. There's a low feed rate regime where A is order epsilon to the 1/2, this A, D is order 1, and there's a very interesting types of oscillations. So in this regime, you get spikes that can oscillate up and down or that can be collapsed monotonically. So there's interesting dynamics near here, not pulse splitting, but you might think this is just one equation. Who cares? There's a clear analogy between the spectral properties in this regime with another reaction diffusion model called the Geer-Meinhardt model. There's a spectral equivalence principle that I think is kind of interesting. There's the intermediate regime that I'll describe later, which is basically a lot of work has been done on this by Dolman et al. In the regime that connects this and this, and there's a nice scaling law that occurs in this regime. But one place where we cannot do any work analytically is in the regime where A is order 1, D is small. So both this guy is small. That's Nishira's original regime where he had the numerical pictures. This regime, you can't make much progress by pencil and paper. So I'm going to first begin by describing what we can do here in this regime. Okay, so let me save, try to be organized. Save this and this. Put them over here. Okay, so the high feed rate regime. Okay. So let me describe it. Okay, so I begin here, and this is I have a copy of this paper. We just submitted it to Physica D, if anybody wants it. But okay, so epsilon is small, D is order one, and A is order one. So I'll show you in a few minutes that this regime, in addition to Nishira's regime, also allows for pulse splitting. Okay, and I'll explain what pulse splitting is and why it occurs in a minute. The first thing one does is, can one construct an equilibrium solution in the form of spikes? Okay, so always with asymptotics, trying to do this is a little bit how you find the scales, but I'll show a picture in a second. You can construct an equilibrium solution, first of all, on a domain from minus L to L, and then you to get a k-spike solution, you just simply glue them across the domain. You glue the regime from minus L to L, you fit it into a box from minus 1 to 1 by letting in the end L equals 1 over k. And that's provided you satisfy a Neumann boundary condition for U at the edge. So basically, you construct minus L to L and then copy it over. So the correct scaling turns out to be like this. Okay? And you end up getting a core problem for capital V and capital U. And so this core problem is, I think, very interesting, but there's no real rigorous results for it. It looks like this. I'll show you a picture in a second. You get a core problem for U and V here. So So it's on the stretched variable. So it goes from minus infinity to infinity, but v and u are both even functions. So the derivative is 0. And there's a matching condition. V goes to 0 exponentially at plus or minus infinity because v is localized. U, on the other hand, will have some gradient at infinity, which represents how it talks to nearby spikes or how it talks with the wall. So I will show you the little derivation on what this b is. This b is actually important. The matching condition determines a b. And I'll give you the formula now, and I'll show you how you find it. The b is proportional to a. It's divided by this hyperbolic cost. Theta 0 is just the square root of 1 over square root of d, so this d. And l is basically the length of my box, minus l to l. So l will turn out to be 1 over k. K is the number of spikes. So this b depends on a and the number of spikes. So let me describe in one transparency where the heck this condition comes from. Where does that come from? So that's one thing I can do that's not so complicated. So I try to draw a picture. Okay, so the picture that goes with this is just this guy. B is local. U is going to be global, minus L to L. There's the scaling for the inner region near here. The outer region for U, basically, the UV squared looks like a delta function as far as the outer region is concerned. So it has some strength of the delta function. V is exponentially small in the outer region. So this is just some scaled version of a delta function. Right? So this is a mollification of a delta function, UV squared. Ux, this should be plus or minus L here, not plus or minus 1. Plus or minus L is 0. So then there's a matching condition. The far field behavior of the inner solution must agree with the outer solution at the origin. U of 0 then, because there's no order epsilon term, U of 0 must be 0. From this Green's function, you can calculate the solution of this in terms of Green's functions. So Ux is determined by, has a jump. On one side it has plus, the other side it's minus. So this jump in the Ux determines the flux of capital U of Y at infinity. So this little calculation tells you where this thing comes from. So I just wanted to sketch where that term comes from. So what do you do with this core problem? You want to ask, what does this core problem look like as a function of B? And it has a very interesting sort of bifurcation behavior. So here's some properties of this core problem, and I'll draw. So this I cannot prove rigorous results on this, but numerically we can do something to show an interesting feature. You can monkey around with equations, and you get a key identity, which basically says since the left-hand side is positive, the right-hand side here is going to be positive, and so the product of u0 v0 are the unknown u and v at y equals 0. It goes, let's go between 0 and 3 halves. So that's a natural way to parameterize solution branches. So between 0 and 3 halves. So as shown numerically, the bifurcation picture that goes with this is as follows. It has a saddle node structure. So if I plot the bifurcation diagram as a function of gamma as the product of u0 times v0 as a function of b, there's a saddle node. Proving the shape of this curve is an open problem. I can compute it, but I cannot prove the shape of this curve. But you can do asymptotics for what these solutions look like on the top part and the lower part in the limit where gamma is going to 0 or gamma is going to 3 halves. And in those limits, you actually get an interesting property of what the solution looks like. So I call here one bump and two bump solutions. So a one bump solution, I'll just draw a picture, don't have to turn the lights on. A one-bump solution is V is looking like this, and this is, let's say, minus 1 over K, 1 over K. That's one bump. And two bumps will look like this. It's just looking like that. But again, this is all within one spike region, minus 1 over K, 1 over K. So that's the V. That's what I call two bump. I'll show a picture in a second. So on either side of this bifurcation point, the saddle node, you get one bump, two bumps, and you get the asymptotic forms of this branch. And if you plot the asymptotic form of that we can get by theory, we miss the nose, but for a good part of it, it's close. So if you plot the solution on the top part and the bottom part, and this will be very much connected with pulse splitting, you get a picture that looks like this. So here's a plot on the top branch, right? So basically some point over here, and then on the bottom branch, some point over there, this is what I mean by two bumps. V is just sort of compact region of it, a smaller region near the origin, which looks like two bumps. Okay, so that's the equilibrium picture, computed numerically, the core problem derived asymptotically. And I'm going to call here the top part the primary branch and the bottom part the secondary branch. Okay, so this leads to, because I remember the formula relates B in terms of A, this leads to a proposition for equilibrium solutions. So here's the proposition. Because I had a formula that relates B in terms of A, this is where this formula comes from, and here's what it says. If epsilon is small, A is order 1, and assume that epsilon A over square root of E is much less than 1. That's my error term in the asymptotic expansion. So this thing here precludes looking at Nishira's regime where D was order epsilon squared. So I can't look at that regime because the correction term is too big. Then there are no K-spike equilibrium solutions that merge onto a one-bump solution over here when A is too big. Namely, when I'm past this fold point, this 1.347 was the infinite line problem. That's this number. This thing is the one that corrects for the finite domain in fact of having K spikes. So if I'm bigger than there, there is no equilibrium solution. So this number of 1.347 was calculated earlier by Muratov and Osipov. Okay, they basically did a computation that did not round this corner, but they came to the end of the world and got 1.347. The extra term represents the finite domain is new. But moreover, there's a nice property here, and I'll show a picture in a second. There's an approximate lining up property of the saddle node bifurcation values. So in the previous talk, we saw ghosts of bifurcation points playing an important role. And this will be important here as well. So if I plot on a suitable norm the bifurcation diagram, this is what it looks like for two values of D. So I'm plotting like some norm of V versus the A. Sorry, that's very bad transparency. But K equals 1, K equals 2, K equals 3, K equals 4. 4 spikes, 3 spikes, 2 spikes, 1 spike. Saddle node bifurcation values, and that's all that pictures for D is 0.75. So they don't really line up so much. They don't occur approximately at the same value. But if you look at the value D is 0.1 on the bottom here, basically this cost doesn't change much. This is a very simple looking formula, unless K is very big. So this, notice this scale is much smaller. There's an approximate lining up point of these saddle node bifurcation values. So that'll be important when we look at Nishira's condition in a little bit. So there's an approximate lining up when D is small. But the finite domain is critical for getting this formula. Okay, so let me keep that there. The next thing is we have to look at the stability of these equilibrium branches. Namely, take that, and this is where I'm just going to tell you the results, but look at the stability of the K-spike equilibrium solutions that we just calculated. What's the stability of the top part? What's the stability of the bottom part? How does it depend on K, etc.? There are two classes of eigenvalues that can be responsible for instabilities. And so the instabilities occur, remember I had a tau times the time derivative? This parameter now is important. So there's two instabilities. Remember I showed you pictures of zigzag instabilities of a ring? That's one class of eigen. Those are the small eigenvalues. An instability of the profile, where it breaks up into spots, those are large eigenvalues. So there's two classes of eigenvalues. Those are translation modes, or Goldstone modes, physicists would call. These are really connected with spikes. These things you wouldn't get for hyperbolic tangent-type interfaces, where lambda's order 1, in like problems in material science. You only get the small eigenvalues. So there's two types of eigenvalues we have to look at. So the first result says, assume that tau is much less than order epsilon to the minus 2. Then you get a universal eigenvalue problem that you have to solve that will determine the stability. So it's in terms of the core solution, which I can only calculate numerically, and we have certain qualitative properties for. But certainly, we can actually calculate the eigenvalues lambda numerically. And what you find is that the secondary branch, the branch below, is unstable. The top parts are going to be stable. So the picture that goes with this is this. Remember my gamma was the parameter with going between 0 and 3 halves for the core solution. So there's 3 halves. 3 halves corresponded to the top part. Between the fold point and 3 halves, that's the top part. That's the bottom part over here. So the bottom part, I got an eigenvalue that's positive in the right half plane, so I'm unstable. On this side of this bifurcation, we're right at the nose. On this side, I'm stable. A proof of that would be nice. All we have here is numerical results. So it's stable when tau is less than order epsilon to the minus 2 to profile instabilities, things that will make it go up and down. Okay? So you then say, what's the structure of the eigen? You're going to hit a double zero eigenvalue at the nose. Right? What does that eigenvalue look like right at the nose of this bifurcation point? And this is important. So at the fold point, right there, one can calculate that the derivative with respect to gamma and the derivative with respect to u, the typical thing you do in bifurcation problems, differentiate with respect to an unknown parameter, is an eigenfunction associated with a zero eigenvalue. What's the profile for, what does this thing look like? The unstable eigen, so this is the one that corresponds to a zero eigenvalue that's not the translation. Okay? Here's what it looks like. It's even. The translation one would be the odd. So this one is even. And it's called a dimple because it's got these two lobes that are negative. This is the pulse-splitting eigenfunction. This eigenfunction here is responsive, is a key thing that actually gives pulse-splitting. So at the nose, you get an eigenfunction that looks like this. So here's an open problem. We've computed this numerically. What properties must the core problem have to guarantee an eigenfunction of this type? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. So the next step is, well, can I get an instability, actually, when tau is very big due to the, remember I said it's stable with respect to Hopf bifurcations, profile instabilities when tau is order at less than order epsilon to the minus 2. If tau is order 1 over epsilon squared, the eigenvalue problem that you get for the large eigenvalues has this extra term. And numerical solution of this eigenvalue problem indeed indicates that there will be a Hopf bifurcation for some tau order epsilon to the minus 2 along the upper branch. So the upper branch here can go unstable if tau is big enough. When tau is less than order epsilon to the minus 2, it can't, but tau is order epsilon to the minus 2, it can. And so here's what tau LH looks like as a function of B. B is the parameterization of the upper branch. So you can get a Hopf bifurcation, and I'll show you that numerically in a little bit. Okay, so we've analyzed one class of eigenvalues. So in other words, disturbances that will lead to a spike going up and down. What about now translation eigenfunctions? Eigenfunctions that give rise to drift instabilities or traveling wave instabilities. So we call them the small eigenvalues. They're the remnants of what is almost translation invariance. Okay, this is very complicated how one calculates this, and I don't expect anybody to remember this, but I'll show you pictures in a minute. You get an ugly, so here's the case of K spikes, okay, and epsilon A square root of D is much less than 1. What I do is I linearize the PDE around a K-spike solution on this upper branch, okay, and I calculate equations for these small eigenvalues. You can actually do it explicitly, okay, and it's kind of ugly, but they're just K transcendental equations for the lambda. It's just everything explicit. The alpha, it's on the next slide. Everything is explicit. They're just K transcendental equations involving the product of tau times lambda. So that's this theta lambda that appears in here and in here. There's k of them, j equals 1 to k, there's the k. Okay. The physical manifestation of the instability, I said, was a drift instability. And so it's the profile plus the derivative of the profile, e to the lambda t. The constant cj come out as being eigenvectors of a matrix eigenvalue problem. And depending on what j equals 1 to k is, ck is 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1. So that'll be an instability that looks like this, varicose. And that's the one actually that's dominant. And then there's other coefficients. But basically you get that, and from this result, you can actually try to plot what the eigenfunctions look like. So there's the only point here on this upper branch, the point on the upper branch is determined by this alpha. That's the only, and you can calculate it in terms of an adjoint problem. And it looks like this. So all I care about this alpha is its sign. I don't care what number it is, all I care about its sign. Its form is determined by a solvability condition of the adjoint. Who cares? You do numerics, and it's positive. Along the upper branch, it's positive. Okay? So that eigenvalue problem gives rise to, you can analyze that thing by a winding number, etc. And so I'll show you what you get here from this. So for the case of one spike, there exists a unique value, tau d sub h, so unique value of tau. Okay, so I've scaled here the tau. I call this tau traveling wave. I've scaled it by this way, and I call tau d sub h the remainder here. So there exists a unique tau d sub h, depending on d, for which is the complex conjugate pair of pure imaginary eigenvalues when tau d is tau d sub h, tau dh. For tau d bigger than that, there are two eigenvalues in the right half plane, and they merge onto the positive real axis when tau is equal to tau dm. So in other words, there is a Hopf bifurcation in the location of the spike. Okay, so the spike can exhibit oscillations, breathing modes, near its equilibrium position. So if you do the computation with that, you get a picture. Here's tau d sub h. And basically this omega is the frequency, it's a scaled version of lambda, as a function of d. So on an infinite line, not a finite domain, on an infinite line, all I would get would be d going to zero, I get this point here, 2. The effect of the finite domain induces the Hopf bifurcation. So here, this little thing here in the complex plane, that's in the right half complex plane, this is for d is equal to 0.0, 0.1. So it makes a small circle in the complex plane. When d is equal to zero on the infinite line, it will just come in as a double zero at the origin. But the effect of the finite domain gives rise to the zigzag. Okay? So then you do a calculation here for k spikes. Okay? And there are k values where you get complex there. So all I want you to read in this is, for k spikes, there are k values where you get complex conjugate pairs of eigenvalues on the imaginary axis, k values of tau. The one you are interested in is which one crosses through first as tau increases, which mode. Okay, so this is what you can show, that there are in fact k of them that cross. Numerically, what we find is that there's one of them that always turns out to be the dominant mode. So here. So it always turns out, here's two spikes, tau 2 is always below. Three spikes, tau 3, tau 2, tau 1. So this is the J equals K mode. That's the mode that had 1, minus 1, 1, minus 1 for the eigenvector. So this is the picture that we compute numerically. So this leads us to this type of conjecture for the instability. So here. And then I'll show some numerical pictures in a minute. So let epsilon be small. Epsilon A over square root of D is much less than 1. Along the primary branch, a K-spike solution first loses its stability to a breathing-type instability. I've heard that that word is wrong. It should be called varicose, because it's looking like this. Okay? At this value, tau dk. So in other words, this conjecture says that the minimum occurs when J equals K. That's what the conjecture says. I cannot prove it, but it's numerically, J equals K always turns out to be the smallest. The form of the eigenfunction looks like the equilibrium position plus a perturbation, right? That's, if I take the real and the imaginary part, it's cosine. And CJs are minus 1 to the J. That's the varicose instability. So in other words, the conjecture relates here to the minimum of the tau Js. So here, we now have all the little ingredients together to describe pulse splitting. And it's really due to criteria developed by Nishira and Uyama in their paper that they had done when they had done the case D is order epsilon squared. There they could do no analysis, but they had a scenario of what is giving rise to pulse splitting. So here's plagiarizing their criteria. Okay? So reaction diffusion system depends on some parameter sigma, maybe singularly perturbed, epsilon squared in front of all the components. That's typically what they had. But suppose bifurcation branches at equilibrium have a saddle node structure for sigma bigger than sigma c, with the fold point occurring at sigma equals sigma c for each branch, namely one spike, two spike, three spike, four spike occur at the same value. Okay, so there's a lining up property of equilibria. Suppose that each upper branch is stable and each lower branch is unstable. Suppose that there is a dimple-shaped even eigenfunction at the fold point location for one component of U, namely one negative lobe and two positive lobes. I should have added here that on one side the thing splits into two bumps, on the other side it's one bump. I should have added that condition in here. Then there's a ghost bifurcation effect. So then pulse splitting should occur just to the left of the bifurcation point, namely with sigma c minus sigma small, due to the ghost of the dimple eigenfunction. So in other words, the pulse splitting should occur due to the effect of the dimple eigenfunction in this bifurcation structure, even to the just a little bit to the left of the bifurcation. So this scenario of lining up a fold point should occur in a singly perturbed limit of reaction diffusion systems if you plot the bifurcation diagram. But all this bifurcation structure of stability, that needs to be checked on a case-by-case basis. So here, with that condition, we have these conditions. We have this. So let me now show you numerically, let me test this. So here's our conjecture using this criteria and the stability stuff that we've just worked out. And I'll show you some pictures. Let epsilon be small, tau is much less than order 1 over epsilon, so no instabilities on the primary branch. No traveling wave instabilities, no oscillations in the spike, etc. And epsilon A over square root of D is much less than 1. Suppose you have even one spike initial data set in at the origin. So I have a domain from minus 1 to 1, and I put a glob of stuff at the origin. Okay, so the final equilibrium state is stable with respect to both the large and small eigenvalues because this condition is true. Okay, and the conjecture has 2m spikes. So this predicts the final pattern, where for some integer m, a is between these two values. Okay, and that's just the very simple threshold that we calculated for the nose of the bifurcation curve. So in other words, okay, I'll show you in relation to this diagram here in a minute exactly what this condition means. So here, let us test this. I can get rid of this because I've got another picture of this. Put this over here. So this is something that we can test. So here's the pictures. So here, I've taken here one value of the parameters. This is the bifurcation diagram when epsilon is 0.02 and d is 0.1. So there's the bifurcation curves, k equals 1, 2, 3, and 4. There are the nodes of the bifurcation diagram. They almost line up. Okay? And I'm plotting here a full numerical simulation of the Gray-Scott model for certain parameter values, and these solid curves indicate trajectories of the maxima of V. So here A is 2.4. Okay? Who cares what the number is, but it's important how it relates to these guys. It's between these two values, AP4 and AP8, the threshold for 4 spikes, the threshold for 8 spikes, is between those two values. So AP4, if it's bigger than AP4, which it is here, this 4 will split up into two spikes. Namely, each one will split up into something like this. So if I'm a little bit to the right of this guy, the 4 branch will split up into 8. Okay, each one will split. So if I'm in this range, this conjecture says I should, in the end, have 8 spikes. So it doesn't say how it's going to get there, etc., but in the end, I do have 8 spikes. Okay. Let's test this again with a different set of data. So here I've made up my own data. Okay. This compares with other dimensionless formulations, and it's this. So there's another dimensionless formulation of the Gray-Scott model in this regime that starts off with this, for which there's been numerical experiments in the past. So this is one set of units that Dolman et al. Has used. Reynolds initially had done this. Pearson initially had used these units. In terms of our dimensionless groupings of the parameters, this script D, this BD, all these parameters, this is how they scale in terms of our units. So we had A is equal order one. Okay, so there's a nice picture. And so the first person to illustrate pulse splitting in this regime was a paper of Dolman et al. In SIAM 2000 in the semi-strong regime. So he used these parameter values. They used these parameter values. And so for us, that corresponds to A is 2.109. That's the critical one. Tau is 4.74. No, should be no instabilities in the drift. So if you calculate from this little formula, which is so simple, what AP2 and AP4 are, that's that, right, and AP8, you get that A is between 2.1 is between AP4 and AP8. So you should get an 8-spike final state. And this is exactly what they computed. So the picture that they computed was this. So there's an 8-spike final state. That's experiment one. Okay? So experiment two that they had is just a little bit different. Experiment two is, okay, so the other parameter values that they used, the A is 1.483. It's between those two values. So I would predict four spikes from this. AP2, so we get four spikes as a final state. And so that's what you get in the bottom over here. It's interesting here that the dynamics indicates pulse splitting and then it re-glues itself back together again. So I can't say anything about this, but the final state is indeed four spikes. Okay? There's another experiment that was done in the past, and this is actually in Reynolds' original paper, and Crampton and Maney had reproduced this numerical experiment, was different other parameter values. You get A is between those two values, so from their paper, and again, you get H-spike final state. So what I don't think that this thing can do is predict what's going to happen if the A is very close to that saddle node bifurcation, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. This is an asymptotic theory. This is not, I only work with wiggle signs, asymptotic. So that shouldn't be, so there's maybe an order epsilon error term in this or so, or what have you, but it's, if you're sufficiently far away from the nose of that curve, I think this thing can be used with some success. So let me show you some pictures, and then I'll start the next topic, which is smaller. What do you do here when it's off-center? We have no real theory to predict what happens when it's off-center. Spike starts off-center. A is 3 here. The only difference now is A is 4. There are the thresholds. Here I get 4 spikes. Here I get 3 spikes. The only thing that this rules out is one spike equilibrium doesn't exist. A 2-spike equilibrium doesn't exist. It could be 3 or 4. I don't know. So to answer which one's going to end up with, you'd have to look at the dynamics. So our theory is limited in that sense. Okay. Let me show you the threshold for instability due to these varicose instabilities. So here, one spike solution centered at the origin. So this is a narrow range near the origin. One spike, okay? I perturb it a little bit. The threshold for a traveling wave or a drift instability is 55. A hop bifurcation in the amplitude will occur when tau h is 230. That comes from the theory. So here, if I take 71, 54, or 50, so 71 is bigger than 55, 54 is less than 55, this thing is within about 10% of the threshold. But here you get an oscillation for one spike. And here, if I take the spike exactly centered at the origin, so it's not going to start wiggling back and forth, the amplitude of the spike, the height, will go up and down if tau is on the other side of this threshold. So here's 220, the oscillation dies out. Tau is 235, the oscillation keeps on going. What about two? What about two spikes? So here, let's test the conjecture that the dominant instability is in fact the varicose instability. Let's test that conjecture. So initially, I don't bias it that way. I move this one a little bit to the left. I keep that one at 0.5. That's a two-spike equilibrium. And so the traveling wave instability occurs when tau is 39. If I'm a little bit to the left, it dies out. A little bit to the right, tau is 55, I get this oscillation. And indeed, as time goes on, it synchronizes into that type of varicose. So that's in when that is, so it looks like they're doing West Coast swing, going back and forth. Okay? So this type of an instability based on linearizing a PDE around a well-developed spike, I think is novel. And so here, depending on the value of tau, again, you can get Hopf bifurcation in the amplitude. Okay. So last two pictures of this, and then we'll change gears for a minute, is this. Instabilities of three spikes. So traveling wave occurs at 49, and this is what a varicose instability looks like. It's not biased that way initially. So again, it all kind of looks, it looks exactly like the conjecture says. And the threshold is not, it's not perfect, but it's not bad. It's within about 10%. And now this is something that I cannot explain. This is in the realm of dynamics. Look at this. If you increase tau to be quite big, you can get something that looks qualitatively similar to what I saw in the simulations in 2D of Roy Williams, where a pulse will split, combine together, and that's what's happening here in 1D. You start with something at the origin. If tau here is small, like 6.8, it should go to a four-spike equilibrium solution for this value of A, because it's between those two values. So indeed, that dotted curve is exactly what happens. But if tau is big, 20, it tries to get to two spikes, and then it splits, it glues itself back together, it comes here, it splits again, it splits, glues, right? And keeps on, seems to do that forever, at least as far as we can see. If tau is even bigger, tau is 30, exhibits a big periodic oscillation, large-scale periodic oscillation. So that I cannot explain, but that's qualitatively something that, that really, you, to explain that, you would need full dynamics. Okay. Let me leave that, and let me do, in my 10 minutes, a little bit of another issue with this. So here, so where is my transparent? I said I was going to save it. So here, I've described this. I want to give you now some idea of what happens in these regimes, and I'll have to be a little bit brief and just show you the phenomena. But, so in this low feed rate regime, I want to ask, what is the thing that replaces the usual thing when one does a Turing stability analysis? The eigenvalues come out as being the roots of some characteristic polynomial. Maybe it's ugly, but that's usually how it comes out. How does the stability manifest itself in this semi-strong regime for looking at the stability of spikes? What's the thing that replaces that? That's the thing I want to say in here. So in the low feed rate regime, there's a whole other set of phenomena that occurs. So here's A is order epsilon to the 1/2, and I do a rescaling of the equation. So this script A now appears here. The only difference with this rescaling is that I get an epsilon minus 1 here. So this term looks like a delta function, since this nu is localized. Okay? So, here's what you get in that regime. Okay, I'll show you a picture of what the equilibrium solution looks like. You get equilibrium solutions that look like this. There's V, I'll show you the formula in a minute. Not so interesting. There's V, there's U. U is the dotted line, U is global, V is local. And there's a formula to describe this construction. The V is a sum of basically homoclinic orbits. The U is really determined by Green's functions. Okay? So the formula that goes with this picture is in fact this. Don't read all the details. And it's a muddy transparent. V is a sum of homoclinics. U in the outer region is basically a sum of Green's functions. But there is an interesting saddle node bifurcation property here that these solutions only exist if script A is big enough. So there'll be some other saddle node bifurcation value that's not connected with pulse splitting. And so what does the bifurcation diagram look like? So this formula, if you plot this norm on the bottom, as a function of script A, you get a bifurcation diagram that looks like this. It's a little bit complicated. Okay? So let me try to say a few words about this. So there's a satellite bifurcation value for each number of spikes. And again, what we want to do is look at the stability of each of those branches. Can you get any new phenomena on these branches? I call this the small solution branch. Even though the amplitude here is bigger, it's small because the U is small. But it's basically the top part, the large part I call the thing on the bottom. Okay? So along the bottom branch, it's always unstable. But the top part has an interesting stability property. So, what does that look like? So here is where this, looking at one little model, in fact, is a little bit universal in a sense, in that there's phenomena associated with this that is very similar to other reaction diffusion models. So here's the question. What replaces the characteristic polynomial that you usually get with Turing stability analysis? The answer is, typically, they're non-local eigenvalue problems. So the thing that determines the stability on this upper branch, at least on order one timescales, large eigenvalues, Hopf bifurcations, is a non-local eigenvalue problem. There's some multiplier here, which I have a formula for in a minute, and there's an eigenvalue parameter appears in this multiplier. There's an eigenvalue parameter here, lambda. The eigenfunction here is phi. The W is three-halves sesh squared. W is the homoclinic. So this is a non-local eigenvalue problem, and all you ask for, under what conditions does this guy have eigenvalues in the right half plane? So this is the thing that replaces the characteristic polynomial. Now, one thing that I thought was quite interesting when we did this was that the multiplier that appears here, you might think, oh, that's the same, that's just restricted to the Gray-Scott model. This multiplier here is identical to what you get for another reaction diffusion model called the Gehr-Meinhardt model. So there's another reaction diffusion problem, I'll write it up, put it up in a minute, for which this multiplier is, I can just write it down. So there's a spectral equivalence principle, so that if I study the Gray-Scott model and study the Gehr-Meinhardt model, all I really have to do is look at one class of eigenvalue problems. So I think that this thing, the type of eigenvalue problems of this type, will be reasonably universal for looking at stability of spike solutions. So what does that eigenvalue, what does this chi GH look like? It's this. Let me tell you what the eigenvalue problem is. Put this back up in a minute. So for this other reaction diffusion model, known as the Gehr-Meinhardt model, there's a completely different reaction diffusion model. Very, very different in form, known as the Gehr-Meinhardt model introduced by Meinhardt. One can do the same analysis to get an eigenvalue problem that looks like this. It's the same thing. All I have to do is change the powers and the nonlinearity. It's the same class of eigenvalue problems that one can study. So I think that universality is quite nice, but let me show you what you get from this eigenvalue problem, and then I'll stop. Let me show you what phenomena you get, what type of instabilities. So there's a long story with this, but I'm not going to have time at all to do this. Let me show you, way too many transparencies. Let me show you what you can get. There's two types of instabilities that can occur. Okay? And so you look at the non-local eigenvalue problem and you try to prove rigorous results on this. When can eigenvalues enter the right half plane? And if so, how do they enter the right half plane? So there are some thresholds on the A, on this script A, so that if A is less than some critical value, there'll be one positive eigenvalue on the real axis. This can give rise to what I call a competition instability, whereby I perturb the initial heights of the spikes, and very quickly in time, t is 150, two of them get killed monotonically, and two of them then saturate to some new level. So this is on basically an order one period of time. That's one type of an instability that can occur due to an eigenvalue entering the right half plane along the real axis. So this type of instability is possible. There's also another type of instability that's what I call a synchronous instability. So, do I have a picture of this? Okay, where is this? Okay, let me show the types of instabilities. So there's two different types of instabilities that can occur. This guy, where you can get an instability due to a competition. Why is it a competition? Because the form of the eigenfunction can serve as the sum of the heights. But you can also get a synchronous instability, whereby you get basically all four spikes, even if they're initially perturbed to be different heights, will all start oscillating up and down with a common amplitude and phase. And so, because all the CJs are one. So this non-local eigenvalue problem is the thing that replaces the characteristic polynomial, and one has to study it rigorously to look at the different types of instabilities. Okay, there's a whole story that goes along with that that I don't nearly have time to do. And do I even find my conclusion? You know what? I don't know where my conclusion thing is. Let me just tell you what I think is a nice problem to look at. Okay, so I think it's a nice extension to look at problems whereby you're linearizing around spike train solutions. Okay, so try to go beyond the initial thing of linearizing around spatially uniform solutions. So all we've done really is the first step in that direction, linear instability. What type of instabilities can you get? How can you explain pulse splitting behavior? Right? How can you try to get competition instabilities from spikes? What's the next step, though, in a program of that form? Would be to do a weakly nonlinear theory based on linearizing around the spike and then try to derive a Ginzburg-Landau equation. Are the hop bifurcation that you get subcritical or supercritical? Can you sort of do predictions on sort of those type of bifurcations? So weakly nonlinear analysis based on now that we have the linear theory. Another thing is that I should mention that a lot of this work, actually a lot of it's rigorous. The pulse splitting stuff is certainly not, the core problem is certainly not rigorous, but it does not rely on dynamical systems techniques. So there's hope that we can actually do problems in multi-dimensions. We did the ring problem about splitting up into zigzags. There's hope in actually doing this phenomenon in multi-dimensions. A good open problem would be to look at the effect of this ghost bifurcation problem, but what about the pulse splitting regime? This little core problem, it's a four-dimensional system, the one that I had described. Can you qualitatively tell me, why do I have a dimple eigenfunction? I compute it numerically. What properties give rise to a dimple eigenfunction? What can you say about the shape of that bifurcation curve? I can't say anything like that. But I'm just saying, I think it's in this type of regime where you're linearizing on solutions of this form, there's a whole other class of phenomena that I think is rich and that could be explored further. So I apologize for my confusion and mess, but I'll stop here.